Thank you very much. Just to remind everyone and those who are joining in the middle, we had three sessions up to now. The first one was the general problem of faith versus reason. How can one both believe in the Torah, and or how do Jewish philosophers teach that one could believe in the Torah, the divinity of the Torah, the truth of the Torah, and still accept philosophy and science and the results of reason, could use their reason in order to understand the Torah better. So I talked about certain of the different strategies used by the Jewish thinkers, the important Jewish thinkers in the Middle Ages. The second session talks about the problem of the existence of God and the creation of the world, and whether or not one has to believe in creation in order to believe in God, or if there is a God, how could God even have created, because that would cause a change in God. Last week I talked about revelation and prophets and the reasons for the commandments, and why is it that God, as it were, chose the Jews? Why did God give the Torah to the Jewish people? What is the special relationship between Jews and God, and why did that come about? So today what I want to talk about is what about reward and punishment, about personal providence, about the philosophical problems which arise from Jewish beliefs in the good and evil, and being rewarded and being punished. So let me start out by saying that the Bible has a very, I would say most of the Bible has a very simple view of the question of reward and punishment. And that view is good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. Now, there are two problems with this sort of neat scenario, good things to good people, bad things for bad people. The first one is an empirical problem. We happen to notice that there are many good people who suffer terribly, and there are many bad people who seem to be doing fine in life. So how is that even possible that the Bible should teach that? And the second problem is the philosophical problem. Just as God, in a sense, can't change from not creating to creating, if God is unchanging because God can't change to be better, or can't change to be worse, or can't change to be the same thing, how can God know individuals? Because if God knows, for instance, this lecture series is going on right now, did God learn this today, or did God learn it when Torah in Motion sent out the advertisement? Did God know that I was going to be giving this talk and talking about God? And if God did know it, did God know it from eternity? And if God knew it from eternity, does that mean that I had no choice but to accept Rabbi Kelman's invitation? I mean, how is it possible for God, in a sense, to keep a record of people and their behavior and act accordingly? So let's start going back to the Bible. When I said good things happen to good people, but we have one book of the Bible which teaches us that you could be a good person and terrible things could happen to you, and that's the book of Job. So the book of Job starts with a very pious man, presumably not Jewish, and who, because of a sense of bet between God and Satan, suffers terribly. And he says, I don't understand this. I was a good person. So his friends, so-called friends, came to comfort him, to console him, and basically they said, by the way, you weren't such a good person. You suffered because you were bad. And that's, I don't know if you have friends like that, but I don't think that's a very good way of showing friendship. Okay? Basically, the author of the book of Job doesn't have an answer for us. The author of the book of Job says that basically Job has no right to ask these questions, and that ultimately, God is the one who decides, and humans have to live with that. And Job, in a sense, accepts that as the answer. but still not particularly consoling for the reader who knows that in real life there are people who try to do their best, even are very righteous people, and then who suffer. Now, the rabbis, after the Bible, were aware of this problem as well. I mean, everyone is aware of the empirical fact that there are righteous who have difficulties and there are wicked people who seem to be successful. And the rabbis called this in Hebrew, they call it tzaddik v'ralo, rasha v'tov lo. A tzaddik, the righteous person who has bad things happening, evil happening to him, and rasha v'tov lo, and the evil person who has good things happen to him. So the rabbis had a number of different explanations. So for instance, if we say that bad things happen to a good person, maybe the good person wasn't good, and maybe the bad things weren't bad. Or if good things happen to bad people, maybe the bad people aren't bad, and the things that happen to them aren't good. I mean, think about someone who wins the lottery. We'd say, oh, that's wonderful, he won the lottery. That's a good thing that happened to him. And yet, on the other hand, oftentimes winning the lottery is not such a good idea and causes a person all kinds of problems. So that was one explanation the rabbis had. Another one is that perhaps the wicked person the wicked person benefits from the fact that his parents were good, and she gets this reward as sort of a favor to the parents. Or the righteous person is the child of evil parents and suffers as a result. Not exactly perhaps fair, but we do have an idea that our parents' behavior has an influence upon us and how we react to their parents' behavior. Or the rabbis would just say that it will all be taken care of in the future time when the Messiah comes or the world to come or the afterlife. And these terms, different terms, Yimot HaMashiach, the days of Messiah, Olam Haba, the world to come, are not presented consistently by the rabbis in the Talmud, in the Midrash. So the medieval thinkers had to come up with explanations as to what those terms meant and how they helped solve the problem of evil or the fact that the righteous might suffer. Let me start with the philosophical issues involved. If we look at the problems called theodicy, justifying God, we see that there are four statements that believers would like to think are true. One is that God is all-knowing or omniscient in the technical term. One is that God is all-powerful, omnipotent. Third one is that God is all-good, omnibenevolent. And the fourth statement is there is evil in the world. Well, one can't accept all four statements. What do I mean by that? That if God is all-knowing and all-good and all-powerful, there can't be evil in the world. Because if there's a possibility of evil, if God knows it's going to happen, and God is good, and God is powerful, then you won't have that evil. Now, it's possible to give up on one of the omnis. You could say God is omnibenevolent. God wants only good. God is omnipotent, is all powerful. But God is not omniscient. God doesn't know everything. So there's a lot of evil things going on in the world, and God just doesn't know. Or we could say God knows, and God could prevent the evil. But God is not omnibenevolent, is not all good. And therefore, God doesn't care if bad things happen. Or we could say God knows what's happening in the world. God wants it to be good. But God isn't all-powerful, not omnipotent. So we have these three statements about God which are incompatible. with the fourth statement about the world, that there's evil. So if one wants to try to reconcile them, probably the easiest way is to get rid of the idea of evil and to say that evil doesn't exist. Now, obviously that's very difficult, but people involved in what's called theodicy and justifying God, tziduk ha-din or tziduk ha-el, try to explain that evil isn't evil. So again, let's take Rav Sadia Gaon in the 10th century, who basically says that one can explain things that look like evil. So in addition to saying maybe evil isn't evil and good isn't good, but for instance, he says that during this lifetime, we accumulate positive merit points for observing the mitzvot, and we accumulate negative demerits for violating the commandments. And in the sense, we have an accountant who takes the count of what's going on. And then after 120 years, we put our magnetic card into the great ATM in the sky. And if it shows that we have a positive balance, we get a good reward. And if it shows we have a negative balance, that's no good. So what does Sadia say? He says there are people who are generally good, but they have some sins. They have some demerits. So what does God do? God punishes them in this world. So in the next world, they'll have only good. On the other hand, there are people who are overly bad, overall are bad. And what does God do? God gives a reward for their good things they do in this world. So in the next world, he can punish them completely. So that's one explanation Sadia gives. Another explanation is that the suffering that people have in this world is in order to give them greater reward. In other words, God is, I won't say testing them, but God is saying, look, I'll make you suffer a little bit in this world, but then I can give you even greater reward in the world to come. And Sadia and the other, this basically takes us from the Islamic theology, the Kalam that I mentioned in the past. And they had the same idea, but not only did they say about people that they would get a greater reward because of suffering. There are people or there are children who certainly can't be suffering because of anything they did wrong, and therefore that must be in order to give them a reward in the future. And they extended it even to animals. But according to this view, animals, if for instance, if you sacrifice an animal or you slaughter an animal to be your food, God will reward the animal in the future. In fact, Sadia says, in terms of sacrifices, that the animal who was sacrificed, was killed, or slaughtered for food, would have died at the exact moment of the slaughter, of the killing. But if, as a result of being sacrificed or slaughtered for our benefit, for our food, if there was a greater pain to the animal than it otherwise would have done, than dying in the bosom of his family, the animal even will get reward for that. So God can't do any evil, even to animals. So a lot of discussion about circumcision of infants. The pain the infant has will be rewarded. So this is Sadia's way of explaining how what looks like evil really isn't evil. I say Judah Halevi did not concentrate very much on this question. He does say that because Jews had a special relation with God, and we know about the special relation with God because we know from the Torah, we know prophets had a special relationship, that because of the special relationship, the Jews can be sure that they will be rewarded, if not in this world, in the world to come. At that point, the Khuzari, the king of the Khazars, who's the interlocutor with the Jewish sage in the Khuzari, says, how come in this world there isn't this relationship between God and the Jewish people? Why are Jews in this world, why are the Jewish people oppressed, discriminated against? Why do they suffer? In fact, he said, you know what? If you say it's because the humility or because they take upon themselves the suffering. He says if this is because you have no choice. And if you did ever have a choice, if the Jews were ever had power, they would kill as well. It's a very famous passage in the end of the first book of the Kuzari. And the sage says, you know, you're right, you've found my sore point. And many people quote that today, and now that we have a Jewish state where Jews do have power. It's not clear that the answer, you found my sore point, you've embarrassed me, really refers to this Jewish misuse of power. There's another way of reading this passage. But still, the idea is that Jews can rely on God because of the special relationship the Jewish people have with God, as expressed by the chosenness that I discussed the last time about how the special quality passed down by Adam to individuals until Jacob and then the whole Jewish people. Okay. We look at Maimonides, this whole theodicy of God will take care of people, that God knows who is suffering, and if it's unjust suffering, God will take care of it. This goes out the window. It's not that Maimonides is not at all in this mindset. And basically, he agrees that evil doesn't exist, that evil is just the absence of good. But he says, if we look at the world, why do bad things happen? So he says, first of all, people are made of matter. That matter, by its very nature, is weak, it's vulnerable, and people will suffer as a result of being of matter. He says that you can't, if you don't want to be a human being, if you don't want to suffer, you can't be a human being. All human beings suffer. They're born, they die. Death is actually good because it gives us recycling, in a sense, of humanity. So that's the first reason. The second reason, he says, what people do to each other, wars and murder. But he says this is somewhat, this is not very often. Because we look around, most people are never murdered. Most people are not killed in wars. Most people do not suffer at the hands of other people, at least terrible things in the hands of other people. And the third reason for evil, he says, is what people do to themselves. That people are always on the lookout for superfluous things, things they don't need, luxuries. People, for instance, he says, will put themselves into danger and not to make enough to live by, but in order to become rich. And some of you may know that Maimonides' brother, David, son of Maimon, was the family representative in the jewelry trade, and his boat sunk between Yemen and India. It caused Maimonides great pain. For a year, he was in extreme depression. So he's saying that bad things happen to people when they overextend themselves, when they do what they shouldn't be doing, when they're looking for riches. And he says, if you look at the world, the thing that people need most in life in order to survive is air. And that you have it all over the place. You don't even have taxes on air, at least not yet. All right? The next thing you need after that is water. And water is prevalent in most of the world, but not as prevalent as the air. And after that, you need food. You need basic food. And that's also cheap and available, at least in Maimonides' day. So if you really are looking for things that you don't need, then you can cause harm to yourself. So for Maimonides, evil does not exist. One can still think of God as being omniscient, omnibenevolent, and omnipotent. Of course, those terms for Maimonides are perhaps different than what people understand them. So I want to go now to talk about providence. Rabbi Kelman kept on referring to Hashgacha Pratit as personal providence, which Maimonides says, interestingly enough, he says there are five views on providence, of God's watching out for people. The first view is of the Greek philosopher Epicurus, who's the sort of the toponym, the name of which we give to the heretic, the Epicurus. But Epicurus was a Greek philosopher who taught that everything was done by accident. There's no guiding hand. Things are by chance. So there's no providence whatsoever. After that, he cites the view of the philosopher Aristotle. What Aristotle taught us, according to Maimonides, is that providence is general, is over for species, but not for individuals. So that God worries about the species of dogs. When I say worries, it doesn't really worry, but provides for dogs, but has no knowledge of Lassie or Rin-Tin-Tin or any other dog. God knows humanity. God doesn't know human beings. The third view, he said, is of the Muslim group, the Mu'tazila, who say that everything is done by God's wisdom. That God, this is what Sadia basically says, anything that happens to someone is because God knows it's happening and it's for a good reason. The fourth group, the Asherites, say everything is according to God's will. What God wants to be done, that's what happens. And then he says the view of the Torah is that God acts by justice, that one receives the results of one's activities. Good people who do what's right justly deserve reward, and people who are bad justly deserve punishment. Well, that sounds good, except for then Maimonides says, and now I'll tell you what I think about it. In other words, in a sense, he's rejecting what he says is the Torah's view and puts in its stead his view, which is providence is a function of one's intellectual perfection. The more one knows, the more that one is close to God by recognizing God, the greater one's providence. Now, providence isn't necessarily protection. It means that one is in sync with God. Let's put it that way. But that also means that if one is not intellectually accomplished, then one doesn't have providence. And Maimonides says that someone who's not without developed intellect is basically an animal. And unlike Sadhu, who said that animals have providence, that God will reward them for any suffering, Maimonides says that's ridiculous. Animals have no reward and punishment. Animals do not have an intellect. There's no communication. There's no connection between animals and God. But basically, there's no connection between human animals and God unless they've developed their intellect. And a number of times in Maimonides' guide, he says that sometimes people are on the level of animals, and just as one can kill animals for a good purpose, or because in order to prevent bad things from happening from these animals, so too humans sometimes are liable to the death penalty. So Maimonides is basically saying God doesn't watch over individuals. God doesn't take care of people as people. So in a sense, it sounds very much like Aristotle, but he adds a caveat when he explains the book of Job. What Maimonides does in his commentary on the book of Job in the Guide of the Perplexed is to say that the different views expressed in the book by Job, by his friends, by Elihu, who comes to the end, these represent the different philosophical views of providence, which he had outlined earlier that I mentioned before, the five views. And what does Job learn from his experience? According to Maimonides, he started out by thinking that good things happen to good people. And then he realized it didn't happen that way. It didn't happen that way with him. And by the end of the book, what he realized is that God's providence for us is not like our providence over other species or other people. That God's knowledge of us is not like our knowledge of other people or other species. And therefore, in a sense, you shouldn't expect anything. And when nothing happens or when bad things happen, you're not disappointed. Job started out being very upset because he thought as a good person, he didn't deserve to suffer. By the end of the book, when Job thanks God, he realizes that those expectations were unrealistic, were not true. And therefore, he, in a sense, felt good about what the bad things that happened to him. So there are different, Maimonides presents different ideas of providence in this book, but it would seem from all of them, the idea that God knows what every single person does and God can reward and punish, and there's a accountancy that you collect mitzvah points or you collect sin and demerits. This is far from Maimonides' point of view. It is a very intellectualist view of reward and punishment and of providence. And if we're talking about reward and punishment for Maimonides, the whole idea of reward and punishment is not physical. It's not you'll become rich. It's not if you do the commandments, you'll have lots of rain. It's not that if you are, if you violate the commandments, you'll suffer greatly. It's a case of the Torah promises physical rewards and punishment only as an educational tool. And Maimonides gives a very nice example. He says a child starts out at school, goes first day to first grade, Shalom Kita Aleph, we say in Hebrew. And in order to get the child to learn, the child is promised all kinds of things. Like I know in the Ashkenazi tradition, they used to take children to school the first day with cakes and put honey on them, make it very sweet. Even to this day in Israel, they'll give out candies the first day of learning so that children will think that learning is sweet. And Maimonides describes that as the child gets older, it's necessary to up the ante all the time. Now, if it's enough to give him we call in Israel a bisli and bamba, the little nosh treats. A little bit after that, they're going to want clothes. A little bit after that, they're going to want a car. A little bit after that, they're going to want the money. So Maimonides says you keep on having to up the ante until the person realizes by him or herself the importance of learning and internalizes learning on his or her own by himself. Okay? So the promises of the Torah are just a way of getting people into learning, and the goal is to wean them away from these physical promises. And Maimonides is fond of quoting the passage in Pirkei Avot, the chapters of the fathers, about don't be like a slave, a servant, who serves the master in expectation of getting reward. Be like the servant who serves the master without any expectation of reward. But if you do serve the master with expectation of reward, you won't get any reward because you haven't perfected your intellect. You don't know what the truth is. It's only if you do it sort of without any expectation of reward, then you can have a reward. But what is that reward? For Maimonides, it's survival of death and it's life in what he calls the world to come, Olam Haba. I mentioned before that rabbis use the term Olam Haba. It's unclear what they meant by it, but for Maimonides, it's clear that Olam Haba, the world to come, is a world after death. So there are, among our forebearers, those who are ready in Olam Haba. Someone, I was talking in synagogue last night, many of these same issues, and they said something about difficult to get into Maimonides' world to come. It's difficult to survive. And I said, yes, in Maimonides' heaven, there's lots of room there. Because in order to get there, according to Maimonides, you have to be an advanced philosopher. And that's not possible for most people. But for Maimonides, those people are sort of background noise, that the world is created for the purpose of the intellectuals. What about those who don't reach that level? What about those who people who are not capable of surviving death because their intellect was not perfected? This has to go, by the way, back to Aristotelian psychology, how people are born, the people are born with potential to learn, unlike Plato, who thinks that people were born having known this soul, having known all knowledge, and that, and learning is just remembrance, and remember what one once knew. So according to Maimonides, if you're a person without intellectual accomplishments, your fate is what, using the traditional word, karet. Karet means incision or cutting, being cut off. There are many commandments, many command in the Torah, negative commandments mostly, that if one does not, if one violates them, one is karet. For instance, if man is not circumcised, or if someone eats chametz, leavened products on Passover, or eats on Yom Kippur. These are all called karet, which seem to be some sort of major punishment, but it's unclear from the Torah. What does Maimonides say? Karet means that one doesn't survive death. After death, that's the end of it. But that means that the believing Jew who observed the commandments and believed in God, but somehow thought that God had a body or God had physical characteristics, that person is cut off after death. In the same way, the greatest sinners are also cut off after death. Now we want, say we, many people think that if greatest sinners in this world are not punished in this world, at least they should be punished in the world to come. And according to Jewish tradition, one would think that if someone loves God and observes the commandments, but is simple and doesn't have philosophical sophistication, that that person should get some kind of reward. And certainly the fate of the simple believer who fulfills commandments and the fate of the worst wicked people in the world shouldn't be the same fate. But according to Maimonides, it is, because the only way to survive death is through intellectual perfection. And it's not even clear that the survival of death is individual for Maimonides. That if what survives from me after life, after death, are those intellectual truths that I have accumulated, and those intellectual truths are universal, then maybe I don't exist as an individual. I only exist as part of this universal truths. It's a little bit complicated. I don't want to get into the details. So for Maimonides, what we have is you live your life, you perfect yourself, you don't observe the commandments for the purposes of getting mitzvah points, you don't do it for the purposes of getting reward. I mentioned last week that for Maimonides, the Torah is intended to help people perfect themselves and not for the purpose of intrinsic value in these commandments other than having a good society and learning truths. And this for Maimonides is the world to come. Now, other people say, no, the world to come refers to what happens when this world is destroyed or when this world changes greatly. And that would bring us to the Messiah. So if the Messiah brings about the world to come, one has to think about what the Messiah exactly does. What's the point of the Messiah? So for Maimonides, here too, his explanation is very rationalistic. The Messiah is a human being, a prophet, descendant of David, who will bring about Jewish sovereignty. The Messiah doesn't have to perform miracles. The Messiah doesn't have to do anything special. What the Messiah has to do is gather Israel, the people of Israel, the Jewish people, to the land of Israel, rebuild the temple, reinstitute the sacrificial service and bring about basically a time of world peace and harmony. Now, I guess many people would might think that that's doing a miracle. If that could happen, that would be a miracle. But Maimonides is saying is you don't need the supernatural occasions for to be the Messiah. What will happen is that during the period of the Messiah, when the Messiah comes, this will make, because of the peace and because of the prosperity, it'll be easier to achieve intellectual perfection. So if now in our world where people have to work for a living, where there's violence, there's wars, it's difficult to perfect one's intellect. When the Messiah comes, according to Maimonides, it'll be much easier. That doesn't mean that everybody will achieve perfection. Does not mean that everybody in the time of Messiah will then have permanence of the soul. It just means a large percentage will achieve that. And according to Maimonides, this messianic period is not necessarily permanent. He could reign for a long period of time, and then the world could backslide into the way it is now. And what about resurrection? Resurrection, the idea of resurrection is that people die, and then at a certain time, presumably when the Messiah comes, they'll arise from their graves and take on their bodies again. They'll be the same people they were before they died. And this itself has all kinds of non-philosophical questions. Sadhya Gaon asks all kinds of details. He says, for instance, if someone dies with an infirmity, dies with an illness, dies with, let's say, missing limbs, how will they rise? So Sadhya says they'll rise, they'll be resurrected sick and with the problem they had. But then they'll be cured. What about if you have a person who is killed by and eaten by a lion? Then the lion dies and fertilizes the field. And then then somehow you get the crops from the lion fertilizer or eaten by fish. And how is it going to happen that after all these different changes, a person can arise again from the dead? So for here, Sahaja says, there's some sort of aspect of the human being that remains forever. And that little piece of the human being, from that the world could be, the person could be resurrected. Sahaja asks, how can the land of Israel hold everybody? And after all, there have been so many people who've died. If it's resurrection is only for Jews, let's say, how they all fit into the land of Israel? He says, no problem. He does some fancy mathematics. Of course, in his day, there are fewer Jews had lived throughout history. Sadia actually has a double resurrection. First is a resurrection for Jews who died in the exile. They would have the opportunity to live in the land of Israel and live under a Jewish government, which perhaps not everybody would think is a great benefit, but at least the Messianic Jewish government should be a advantage to live under. And then, according to Sahaja, the world will be destroyed. If you remember from two sessions ago, I talked about one of the proofs of the creation of the world is that the world would be destroyed. So when the world is destroyed, according to Sahaja, there will be a general resurrection, maybe not bodily, but people will be identifiable. And then there will be a great judgment day, where the righteous will be rewarded and the wicked will be punished. One of the rewards of the righteous is to see the punishment of the wicked and say, oh, isn't it so good that we were righteous and look what terrible things are happening to the wicked. And the wicked's part of their punishment is to see how the righteous are enjoying it and how they have to think about how they could have been the good people and they were not. So this was a pretty common view of resurrection, that is actual physical resurrection. People will return to their bodies, they'll be able to be recognizable. But if you look at Maimonides, the question is, why should one want resurrection? What is the value of resurrection? If true reward and punishment are to the intellect, the disembodied intellect, and if the only people surviving death are those whose intellects are sufficient to enjoy the status of being a disembodied intellect, why would they want to come back into a human body? Human bodies, after all, remember, get sick and bad things happen to them, and those bad things are going to happen to them in the time of Messiah as well. There'll be murder, and there'll be illness. So why would anyone who is in the state of beatitude, if we could call it, why would anybody want to return to being in a human body? So Maimonides is obviously, it's various a sensitive issue for Maimonides. He made belief in resurrection from the dead one of the 13 principles of Judaism, but in his introduction to commentary on the Mishnah in Chelek, the chapter Chelek, when he gives the 13 principles, each one of them explains somewhat at length until he gets to the resurrection where he writes, we've already explained it. And he had explained it, but not really at length. And people said, well, how come you don't really explain it? And then the Mishnah Torah is the work of Jewish law. Maimonides hardly mentions the resurrection. So people are saying to themselves, you know what? Maimonides probably doesn't believe in resurrection. Maimonides gives lip service to resurrection, but doesn't believe in it. And that was the first great Maimonidean controversy. Still in Maimonides' lifetime, people are saying that despite his learning, despite his legal acumen, he really is a heretic because he doesn't believe in physical resurrection of the body. So when Maimonides heard about this, he got very upset. He wrote a treatise called Treatise on Resurrection. He defends what he claims is his view, that there will be actual resurrection. And not everybody accepts his defense. Not everybody thinks that he's actually being totally honest when he says, yes, I really do believe in resurrection. Let me just add, it's a very interesting beginning of the Treatise on Resurrection. He says that sometimes when you explain things you think as clear as possible, people still get it wrong. So he says the Torah, the God through Moses gave the Torah, where it says, "My Israel, Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad," that I, "Hear, O Israel, I am the Lord, and the Lord is your God, I am one." And people, he says, the Christians take that to be that you have Shema Yisrael, listen, Israel, Hashem is one, Eloheinu is two, Hashem is three, and the three are one. So the Christians take this verse from Deuteronomy, the centerpiece of Jewish belief, the unity of God, and interpret it to mean that there is a Trinity. So Maimonides writes in his Epistle on Resurrection and says, you know what? If even God can't get people to understand what he's saying, what do you want from me? And then he tries to explain as best he could why he believed in resurrection. As I said, not everybody accepts his explanation. So what I've tried to do today is give some of the philosophical issues behind those aspects of Judaism, which you can call the justice of God, theodicy, justifying God, the problem of evil, the problem of providence. And we see the different Jewish thinkers try to accommodate these traditional beliefs with philosophical rationalism. Perhaps some of them were more successful, perhaps some were less successful, but they were at least aware of the problem. It wasn't enough for them to say, no, I believe, and that's it. It says in the Torah, and therefore I accept it. And the one who gave the most rationalist belief, the most rationalist explanation, is, of course, Maimonides, as we've seen through the course. All right, let me try to, we have a few more minutes, let me try to sum up what I've been trying to do. Through the centuries, and I'm thinking specifically the Middle Ages, which I've been dealing with, there were great attempts of reconciling traditional Jewish beliefs and the philosophy, the science, the reason of the day. So if the predominant philosophy was that of the Muslim Kalam, you have Jews who followed Kalam. If the reigning philosophy, or one important one, is Neoplatonism, we didn't really discuss that at all, but this is a type of philosophy based on Plato's works as reinterpreted through the years, and the idea of God is emanating and different levels of existence. So some Jews adopted those views. And then you had the major philosophical scientific line in the Middle Ages was that of Aristotle, from the time of Aristotle until about the Renaissance, 15th, 16th century. Aristotle was considered to be the authority on science and philosophy. So there were Jewish philosophers who did their best to reconcile Judaism with this Aristotelian philosophy. It wasn't easy. And what I tried to point out is the different strategies different thinkers used in order to justify their reconciliation of Jewish tradition with these philosophy. In general, though, if we look at Jewish philosophy, Jewish philosophers, even Judah Halevi, who is considered to be a non-philosopher, anti-philosopher, the idea was that Judaism has to be rational. Judaism has to be reasonable. Reason perhaps can't prove that Judaism is true, but if reason could disprove a belief in Judaism, or if, I say another way, if reason, philosophy, science disproves a religious belief, then the religion which taught that belief can't possibly be true. Now, Jews use this at length when arguing against Christianity, claiming that Christian beliefs are irrational. But they claim that Jewish beliefs are rational. They weren't always successful. And I guess if someone had been successful, we'd all accept that person's views and thoughts, and we'd be finished with it. But they all, at least the ones I'm talking about, they tried. It was a difficult task. If we look in the modern period, we see the philosophy has changed a lot. And Jewish philosophy, Jewish thought, has also changed a lot. So we have Jewish existentialism, we have Jewish Kantians, we have Jewish Hegelians. Kant, in the late 18th century, demonstrated that certain theological beliefs are not, it's not possible to prove them, it's not possible to disprove them. Kant himself said that God exists as a guarantor of ethics. But because we have so many different types of modern philosophy, we also have different types of modern Jewish philosophers. And I think it's fair to say that the questions I've raised are ones which will never be solved. And that's good for those of us who are trying to teach this. Since it's insoluble, there'll always be work for people like me. Alright? But what I've tried to show is how Jews have pursued the truth throughout the generations. And using tools which they then thought were God-given tools of using their reason. Okay? So I thank you very much. If there are any questions, you can put them into the chat. There is a has some questions from earlier on. Does God have a linear existence? I assume the point of the statement is that since God is everywhere, as it were, at all time, there's no learning. God can be aware of every detail in the world, including the fact that there's going to be this lecture series, without having to learn anything new about it. So that's perhaps one way of explaining it, but it's still very difficult to get one's head around it, that if, for instance, someone's sick and a friend goes to the synagogue and asks for a Misha Berach to be made and even pays for the Misha Berach. So One is saying to God, please cure this person because I'm giving money to cure this person. Now, does God not know that money was going to be given? Did God make this person sick in order to encourage a contribution? And there are all kinds of questions to how this exactly works. And by just saying that God knows everything every time for one knowledge, which is basically what Maimonides tried to say, I'm not sure it solves that philosophical problem. In terms of Joe's friend, since you were being punished, you must have deserved it. That's exactly what Job's friend said. And as I point out, I'm not sure, I don't know how good those are, what kind of friends those are that come and console him by telling him that he's been a bad person, especially since he himself claimed that he wasn't. All right, are there any?
Hello?
Hello, yes?
Yeah, when are you coming?
Could you mute yourself? Does anybody want to make a comment?
Sorry, someone's talking to me. Hold on just a minute, just a minute. Just 1 minute.
I guess I don't know if I can unmute people. So you might want to put it into chat. Or unmute yourselves if you can.
Hi, I'd like to ask a question.
Okay, please.
What if you say that God can change? If you say that God can react to a person's act, in other words, if we have free will, what damage does that do to the rest of Jewish philosophy?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understood, but the question about change and the divine change, why that's bad, I point out that if you say that God can change, and learning something new is part of change, and different behavior, for instance, not creating then creating is change. The answer, the question arises, does God change to be better? In other words, if God is perfect, could God become more perfect? Presumably not. He's already perfect. She's already perfect. So you can't have a better perfection. If God is perfect and changes to be worse, then God now is no longer perfect. Or if we say that God's changed to be exactly the same, then that's not change. So,
but can you say that God changed because the situation changed and any imperfection may have another meaning in what's perfect under circumstances and isn't perfect under circumstances B?
Well, when we talk about God's perfection, we're talking about a being that's better than which cannot be, that you can't think of, even think of something better. Let me go on some of the other comments. If God has a plan for the universe and his plan is good, what is the utility of prayer which is requested to subvert that good plan? Okay, so that exactly is part of the problem of petitionary prayer, asking God for things, as I point out, making a Misha Berachu, even the daily prayers. So Maimonides doesn't say, says once you pray, but Maimonides sees prayer as a regimen for training oneself to achieve this intellectual perfection I talked about. So it's not really, one doesn't literally ask for God for rain or for anything else. And one can ask, but it's not something. This is not something that will affect God. But obviously, petitionary prayer is a problem for Maimonides. Okay, so the relationship, the partnership between God and humans can become more perfect. Well, yes, that is true, but that's a function of human behavior. It's not a function of divine behavior. In other words, God is unchanging. If we become closer to God is because we've done something, not because God has done something. You're talking about prophecy. The prophecy is sort of which is available for people who have prepared themselves to be prophets. So those people closest to God, the prophets who understand what God wants from us, it's because of their understanding, not because God picked them out. So it's, of course, this doesn't fit the biblical description. When God says to Jeremiah, before you were born, I knew you. And so Maimonides says that God knew, whatever knowing means, that the embryo, then the fetus that turned into Jeremiah, had the possibility of becoming a prophet. And when Jeremiah says, but I'm not an Ohi, I'm just a little kid, and Maimonides says, well, that can't be really literally being just a kid, because after all, kids can't get the philosophical perfection in order to be prophets. He says you have descriptions of the Bible, for instance, of Jeremiah, of Joshua as being a kid, and he was 51 years old. So Jeremiah doesn't mean when he's a kid, that he's really a just a teenager or a younger. Always when I teach this, it always reminds me of you have synagogues which have a youth minion in the basement, especially in Israel. You have the minyan se'irim, the minion of the youngsters, and often people there are in their 60s and 70s already. So the same thing with Joshua's, Jeremiah's being. Okay, thank you for the nice comments. Is the Holocaust the ultimate proof of the disconnect between good acts and good benefits to people, and evidence that there's no hashgacha pratzit? Well, in Holocaust theology, there are people who have try to come up with different explanations. If you take the most theological right wing, they'll say there is a reason for the Holocaust, that Jewish sins led to the Holocaust. And you hear, even today, this terrible earthquake in Turkey and Syria, you had one of the rabbis in Israel who's not known for his great tact or his sophisticated theology, said they had the earthquake there because they deserved it, because those are countries which are not sympathetic to Israel, and therefore the 31,000 plus people who killed from an earthquake, it was deserved. So you can always have an explanation of a divine of providence if you're willing to, I'd say, be outlandish sufficiently. I mean, I don't know what kind of God people worship that kills 6 million innocent Jews, but what they say, they're not innocent. Or there was a reason for the Holocaust. It's interesting that among those who say that there's a reason that God punished the Jewish people, they're not always agreeable. They not always agree as to what that sin was. So some of them say that it was a sin of Zionism, whereas others say it was a sin of non-Zionism. Or the reason why the Holocaust was done by the Germans is because the German Jews were the most assimilated. Well, the German Jews were the most assimilated. Why did the non-assimilated Jews in Eastern Europe, why did they take the brunt of it? Or you have the late Rabbi Schneerson of Lubavitch, who said that it was actually a good thing for the Jewish people, that if you look from the outside in an operation chamber, operation room, and you see a doctor with a knife putting the knife into a person lying there, you think the doctor is the most cruel person around, and so you realize that this is for the benefit of the patients. So you have those people who have come up with some those types of explanations. Many Jews are unwilling to accept them. Other people, for instance, Professor Fackenheim, late professor, lived most of his life in Toronto, saw it as a new revelation, the revelation of the 614th commandment, that Jews must survive, the importance of Jewish survival. And there are other explanations, but certainly the challenge of the Holocaust to Jewish theodicy and traditional Jewish belief is a great challenge, which is why it has exercised so many people's minds in the last 70 years. Anyway, I see we're past 2 o'clock. I'd like to thank you for your attention. Of course, it's very difficult by Zoom to know who's paying attention and who's not, but this is what we have to do in order to get the wide audience. So thank you very much, and that'll be the end of this. Okay.